Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. If you woke up this morning feeling like you might get lucky, then you should find yourself a way to make it to Kentucky. And first stop by the ATM and take out all your cash. You needn't worry that to do so would be dumb or rash, because I can guarantee that you won't lose a single penny as long as you take the advice you'll hear right now from Jenny. That would be Jenny Reese of the Louisville Courier-Journal, who joins me each year at this time in order to tell me which horse is going to win the Kentucky Derby. Jenny, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, it's great to be back here. I just wish I had a rhyme to counter with.
Oh, well, next time. Empire Maker is the morning line favorite at 6-5, but being tapped as the favorite in the Derby is at best a mixed blessing, right?
Well, that's right. Overall in horse racing, one of three favorites wins, but in the Kentucky Derby, only one horse in the last 23 years has won. That was 3 years ago, Fusaichi Pegasus. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily a great thing to be dubbed the favorite. And I'm not sure why this is, if we're all just such bad handicappers, or which might very well be. You know, I always have to have truth in advertising when I come in your show, and you do know the last time I had the Derby winner was 1992.
We don't remind people of that. We're moving right along.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Empire Maker won both the Florida Derby and the Wood Memorial, and despite suffering a bruised hoof recently, I gather the word is the horse is sound today?
That's what the trainer says, that everything's a go and he's fine, and getting a little annoyed with all the different ways we're phrasing the question to ask him the same thing. But he was saying on Friday that he didn't even want to say the horse had a bruise. I said, is it correct to say the horse with the former bruise? And he said, yes.
This is sort of a political job you got there.
Absolutely, very much so, especially when you're writing for the hometown paper and they read everything you write. Definitely political.
Empire Maker's trainer is Bobby Frankel. He says the number 12 post position is ideal for his horse. Why don't trainers accept what geometry tells us, that the shortest distance from the gate to the finish line is all the way around on the rail?
Well, and maybe they never got out of math class. They were too busy at the track. But there is actually the one they hate worse than anything. They'd rather be as far outside as possible, which in this case is the 16th post with the scratch of Sir Cherokee on Friday. But they feel like if you're in the rail, horses come over. Everybody's just, their adrenaline's pumping, horses and the jockeys, and they can kind of crush you and make you have to, you know, take back and stuff. And that's why they do not like that rail. Either that or, it's like I said, maybe they missed that math lesson.
Bob Baffert, who's trained three Derby winners, including War Emblem last year, had several Derby hopefuls this spring, but I understand the two best have gone down to injuries, leaving him with the aforementioned Indian Express. Can Baffert magic prevail anyway?
Well, yes, I talked to him Friday morning, and he was much more optimistic than he was when he first came to town. When he first came to town, he said, well, our best shot is just to break, go for it, and hope they don't catch him. But he thinks now this was... is good enough. He just wasn't sure how good he was before, but he really has trained well here, and he's the lightest racehorse in the field with only four horses. And you go back to 1918 to find a horse that had as few races that won the Derby. Mm-hmm. But after last year, nobody is discounting Bob Baffert. After he buys the horse 3.5 weeks early, everybody discounts him, and the horse wins and pays $40-some-odd.
Hunch bettors who are movie buffs, or at least fans of epics full of special effects, may want to put their potatoes on That's What I'm Talking About, owned in part by Steven Spielberg. Will the horse need hyperspace rockets or a time machine to contend?
Well, I think he's got the inherent ability, but he is bucking history. There's only been one Derby winner that didn't race as a two-year-old, which is the case with That's What I'm Talking About. Also, maybe more important, there's never been a Derby winner with 18 letters in his name.
and no spaces between them.
That's right. And so Ron was saying, well, when they named the horse, he wished they could have whittled down one more letter while they were getting it down to the maximum number of letters he can have to have a name registered.
Right.
So he's hoping this horse can take care of both of those things.
Jenny, enough horsing around now. What's your pick?
10 Most Wanted, which has the greatest ball caps of all the Derby horses that they've had made up. You know, usually when horses come to the Derby, the owners have hats made up. And 10 Most Wanted, it looks like sort of like one of those old posters you see in the, wanted dead or alive in the post office. And they're really great. But beyond that, even before the questions about Empire Maker, he was a horse that is just really great-looking horse. He's training superbly. I thought he was going to be a prize. I don't think he is. He'll be a strong second choice, I believe. And Pat Day is jockey, who, I got to say, was the last winner I had, is very confident, the most confident I have seen him in years on a Derby horse.
Based on her calls for Only a Game, Jenny Reese, who joined me from the press box at Churchill Downs, could easily make a comfortable living picking winners at the track. Oddly, she continues to write for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Jenny, thank you for speaking with me.
My pleasure, and happy handicapping.
Thirty years ago, a three-year-old chestnut colt named Secretariat stunned the crowd at Churchill Downs by turning in the fastest ever Kentucky Derby winning time. The Big Red Express went on to win horse racing's Triple Crown in 1973 and achieved a superstar status usually reserved for human athletes. Kathleen Adams recently spoke with two who knew the great horse well, and she has our report.
At age 81, Penny Chenery's chiseled face is virtually unlined, and her handshake is firm. In the decades following Secretariat's impressive Triple Crown win, she has made countless public appearances promoting thoroughbred racing. Surprisingly, she insists few people want to listen to her personal stories about the horse.
They want to tell me about their horse that's related to Secretariat, or where they were when he ran, or that they didn't ever see him, or that they did visit him. But they want to share their part of Secretariat with me.
For those willing to listen, Chenery is more than happy to talk about the once-in-a-lifetime horse she nicknamed Big Boy. Her steel blue eyes light up when she remembers the first impression Secretariat made on her and the folks at Meadow Farm.
Nobody said anything remarkable about him, just that it was a nice-looking, correct chestnut colt. When I did see him, of course, he was always very good-looking, and my reaction was that he was too pretty to do any good.
Secretariat turned two in January of 1972, and French-Canadian trainer Lucien Laurin took the young horse to Florida to train on the racetrack.
All through the spring, when we'd talk on the phone, he'd say, "Well, your big, bold ruler colt doesn't show me much." He said he couldn't outrun a fat man in the morning.
On July 4th, 1972, Secretariat finished fourth in his maiden race at Aqueduct. But Chenery says Lauren's reaction to the loss changed her expectations.
Lucien was very disappointed. Lucien was a fiery fellow, and he kicked the chair across the box and said, "Damn, this horse should never be beaten." And that's the first time I realized that Lucien had high hopes for him. He hadn't told me, but you know, that was my signal.
Also at Aqueduct that day was Newsday turf rider Bill Knack.
He got slammed, he got pushed around, and the only time he got a chance to run was about 3/16 of a mile to go, and he passed the entire field except for two or three horses, and he got beat, finished fourth, but boy, did he look fantastic.
Knack, whose 1975 book, Secretariat, The Making of a Champion, is considered among the sport's best literature, was keeping close tabs on the horse in 1973. That year, Secretariat finished third in the Wood Memorial, a major prep race for the Kentucky Derby. Despite Knack's fondness for the three-year-old, he found himself wondering if the son of Bold Ruler was capable of winning the run for the Roses, let alone the Triple Crown.
I thought, well, this is another Bold Ruler who can't go a mile and an eighth or a mile and a quarter, because Bold Ruler was a speed sire. I did lose faith. You couldn't help it.
Chenery remembers Secretariat characteristically hanging back at the 1973 Derby and letting the other horses move forward.
He took maybe a 1/16 of a mile to get going. He had that huge rear end and big chest, and his running style was to dive with his head, and that would be to get the rear end off the ground. And so it just took him a while to get going. He was very nimble once he got going, but he really did take time to get organized.
Secretariat ran the fastest Kentucky Derby ever. His record time of 1:59.25 still stands. Amazingly, he completed each quarter faster than the previous one, something never done before or since in the history of the mile and a quarter race. Secretariat retired in the fall of 1973. Chenery recalls it was one of the saddest days of her life. She says she'll always remember him as her big, friendly, high-energy horse.
He liked to have people come see him, But he always interacted with a visitor. He wasn't just kind of there munching hay. He'd always look at you. And with me, he was very playful. And if I tried to pet him or pose with him, he would nip. And he nipped Bill Knack.
For Knack, Secretariat represents something very rare.
I have never seen perfection before in sports. I've seen darn close to it. I saw Reggie Jackson hit three home runs on three straight pitches in one game and to win the World Series in 1978, I believe. And I saw Michael Jordan, and I've seen a lot of things since Secretariat died, but I have never seen anything as close to perfect as that horse.
Secretariat died in 1989 from laminitis. He is buried at Claiborne Farm in Paris, Kentucky. For Only a Game, I'm Kathleen Adams in Louisville, Kentucky.
They're on the turn. It's Secretariat is blazing along the first three quarters of a mile in 109 and 4/5. Secretariat is widening now. He is moving like a tremendous machine. Secretariat by 12. Secretariat by 14 lengths on the turn.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org.
Half of a mile away from the rest of the horses. Secretariat is in a position that seems impossible to catch. He's into the stretch. Secretariat leads his field by 18 lengths. And now Price of Prince has taken second, and Mike Gallant has moved back to third. They're in the stretch. Secretariat has opened a 22-length lead. He is going to be the Triple Crown winner. Here comes Secretariat to the wire. An unbelievable, an amazing performance. He hits the finish 25 lengths in front. It's going to be Price of Prince second.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. In the prisons of Bangkok, Thailand, a project entitled A Little Laugh a Day Brightens Your Day is underway. The country's prisons are jammed with more than twice as many inmates as they were built to accommodate. Stress levels are high, and the theory is that laughter will help. Accordingly, the Corrections Department has organized a laughter contest for the convicts. A trophy will be awarded to the convict with the most contagious laugh, and a separate competition will be held for joke tellers. So, did you hear the one about the guy who walks into a bar trying to figure out what's so funny about being in jail in Bangkok?
I'm Dolores Handy with these sports headlines. In yesterday's American League action, Kansas City bested Baltimore by a score of 5-2. Minnesota vanquished Boston 11-7. Cleveland edged Texas 6-5. And Tampa Bay goose-egged Detroit 2-0. Elsewhere, the Yankees beat Oakland 5-3. Toronto topped Anaheim 3-1. And Seattle stopped Chicago 9-2. For Only a Game, I'm Dolores Handy in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the week's sports news with Charlie Pierce. But first, almost everybody knows Jackie Robinson integrated Major League Baseball when he joined the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. Almost everybody knows Branch Rickey, who was running the Dodgers at the time, chose Robinson for the task and was his partner in the challenge. But how many people know about the efforts of a newspaperman named Sam Lacy to bring integration to Major League Baseball before anybody'd ever heard of Jackie Robinson? And how many of them know that Washington, D.C., home of a superb Negro League team as well as the usually woeful Senators, would have been a much more logical place for breaking baseball's color line? Not enough people, according to Brad Snyder, which is why he's written a book entitled Beyond the Shadow of the Senators, The Untold Story of the Homestead Grays and the Integration of Baseball. Brad Snyder joins me now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Brad, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be on your show.
Sam Lacy began trying to convince the owner of the Senators, Clark Griffith, to integrate the Senators more than 10 years before Jackie Robinson joined the Dodgers. What was it that made Lacy feel that the time was right, that it was possible to do this?
Well, I think Lacy thought the time was right in 1933 when he first started writing about this issue. Sam Lacy grew up in Washington, D.C., not far from Griffith Stadium, only a few blocks. He used to shag fly balls for the Washington Senator players, and he was also a semi-pro player himself, so he had seen a lot of the great black players. And he just thought that there was no difference between the great black players and the Senators that he had shagged fly balls for. So this was a very personal issue.
In fact, the Senators for many of those years, at least in the 40s, were awful, and the black players were a lot better than the people employed by Griffith.
That's exactly right. The Senators had one or two good seasons, but for the most part, after 1933, they really just dropped off the map. Clark Griffith didn't have the money or the vision to build a big farm system like Branch Rickey and other folks were doing, and it was really a shoestring operation at that point.
Now, Lacy had quite a challenge in front of him because, along with one of the revered old icons of baseball, Connie Mack, Clark Griffith regarded the attempt to integrate Major League Baseball as a communist plot. Was this just because Paul Robeson and the American Communist Party favored integration, or were there reasons beyond that?
I think that was part of it. I think Landis did this, Judge Landis did this intentionally. In 1943, he had Paul Robeson come speak to the major league owners advocating the integration of baseball. So it was Judge Landis who had put almost a communist face on this issue and really unfairly prejudiced it in a lot of ways. I think Griffith was smarter than that, though. I think Griffith was just using this communist thing as an excuse not to do it and to keep things the way they were, because the way things were very profitable for him.
You mentioned many of the great Negro League players, many of the great players employed by the Grays. Buck Leonard is foremost among them, had a long and wonderful career with the Grays. And there's no doubt that Clark Griffith could have improved the Senators by hiring Buck Leonard, who played many, many games in Griffith Stadium. Would he have been able to do it if he'd wanted to, say, in 1940?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. The thing to remember about Washington, D.C. at that time was it was a southern town, and it was segregated. There weren't signs that said where black and white people should sit and go eat or use water fountains like in Birmingham. But Griffith Stadium, for example, was a segregated place. Mm-hmm. Black fans sat in the right field pavilion. So I think maybe. I think the best answer is maybe. I think the presence of the federal government would have helped Griffith if he wanted to integrate the Senators back then. But certainly there was a racist southern element that lived in D.C. and that would have opposed such a move.
And there was a racist element built into the establishment of Major League Baseball.
Absolutely. I mean, guys like Connie Mack and Clark Griffith, they just thought that this was the way things should be, and they had always been this way. They just didn't believe that there should be anything but separate white and black leagues. I'm not sure if it was a matter of racial prejudice as much as just sort of a backwardsness to their thinking.
Well, and money came into it, of course, because Griffith was making money by renting his ballpark to the Grays when the Senators were on the road, and so he had a stake in not only the ongoing existence of the Negro Leagues and the Grays, but in their being prosperous.
That's exactly right. In 1943, for example, Griffith made about $100,000 between stadium rentals and concessions off the Homestead Grays, and I know that seems like chump change in today's age where Alex Rodriguez is making $25 million.
Almost everything seems like chump change in that context.
But back then, that $100,000 was the difference between Clark Griffith being in the red or in the black for any given season. So that was important money to him. And he really cultivated a great relationship with the Grays owner, Composi.
Brad, it strikes me that for black fans, black baseball fans in that time, the experience must have been surreal. They could sit anywhere they wanted in Griffith Park if they went to see the Homestead Grays play. But then when they went to see the Senators play, they were carefully escorted into the right field grandstand.
Yeah, and that was the thing that really shocked me in researching this book, was that despite the fact that they were forced to sit in the right field pavilion, black fans loved the Senators. They loved them in the 20s and the early 30s when they were going to World Series. But they, even in the late 30s and the early 40s, black fans were still going to Senator games. And part of the reason for that was is that when George Preston Marshall brought the Redskins from Boston, he also brought with him a virulently racist attitude and sort of a hatred for black people, and he made them feel very unwelcome at Redskin games. So black people boycotted the Redskin games, but they would go to the Senator games because it was almost the lesser of two evils and also a fun recreational activity.
Fairly late in your book, you contend that if either Clark Griffith or his nephew Calvin, who ran the team next, had reached out to Washington's black community, there might still be a team in D.C. Do you base that conclusion simply on what attendance at Senators ball games might have been during those earlier years?
Not just that, but I think that you had to embrace them by showing them you wanted them there. And by showing them you wanted them there, you had to scour the country for black talent. I don't think enough of an effort was made by the Senators to get a black superstar or and to see the importance of that. You know, in their entire history, the Senators never really had a black superstar. Now, the Redskins, by contrast, integrated very late in 1962 at the urging and almost forced by the federal government when they moved into RFK Stadium. But then they followed that up with they had Bobby Mitchell and then Charlie Taylor and Larry Brown, three black Hall of Famers. The Senators, even into the early 70s, never really had anyone that the community around which these ballparks were built could rally around.
Your story, discouraging as it sometimes is, has a kind of dual happy ending. Both Sam Lacy, the writer who fought for integration in the major leagues, and Buck Leonard, the slugger who never had the opportunity to play in the big leagues, are inducted into the Hall of Fame. I gather that each managed to avoid bitterness, at least publicly.
Absolutely. And I think for Sam Lacy especially, this was a huge accomplishment because he spent his entire career in the black press. And for people who don't know, he wrote for the Baltimore Afro-American for almost 50 years. And he's still living. He's close to 100 years old. But these were weekly newspapers. They were like national newspapers for the black community because the white daily papers were not covering black sports, black politics, and black entertainment. He just really had a fury and a passion to want to integrate Major League Baseball. And I think that's part of what allowed him for 14 years to carry on what amounted to the same journalism story. Most journalists work on a story for a week or maybe two, and to work on the same story for 14 years until it comes to fruition is really quite amazing.
Brad Snyder is the author of Beyond the Shadow of the Senators, published by Contemporary Books. Brad, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's been a pleasure.
In 1999, Brad Hodder became the first person to complete a transcontinental trip on a lawnmower, setting a Guinness Book record by rolling more than 4,000 miles. Apparently, he was not satisfied with that accomplishment because on March 19th, the intrepid Mr. Hodder departed San Francisco on his custom-made rider with a goal of putting more than 5,000 miles behind him and his presumably achy backside. Mr. Hodder joins me now on the line from Fayetteville, Arkansas. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, as I mentioned, you did begin the race on a mower which was specially built for this cross-country trip, and it had a top speed of about 30 miles an hour, but that, I gather, is no longer your vehicle.
Yeah, we had an unfortunate situation happen to us in San Antonio, Texas. We have this huge 31-foot NASCAR trailer, very visible. It's got a Yardman mower picture on the sides, and then it's got this giant Keep America Beautiful logo and our website all over it. So it's a pretty high-profile vehicle, and that's where we met every morning to begin our day.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked out of the hotel on Easter morning, and we couldn't find it. And after about a half an hour of asking, come on now, seriously, who took the truck? We went into the hotel and just started replaying the surveillance videos and found out that at 1 a.m. it drove off the parking lot and it wasn't one of us behind the wheel.
So much for your custom-made ride. What did you take up the rest of the adventure on?
Well, we were really struggling at that point because Guinness had some requirements. It's got to be a continuous journey. It's got to be a Yardman mower driven every day. And so we were trying to figure out, okay, what do we do on Easter Sunday? Can we find the mower, or do we need to find out other options, or is it time to go home and the charity drive is over. And so we called the police, and they called us about mid-afternoon, and they said that they had found the truck and trailer, and it was dumped on the side of the road about 15, 20 miles from the hotel. Both Yardman mowers were gone, Yardman string trimmers, about $7,000 of the T-shirts that we sell to raise money for Keep America Beautiful, and a lot of personal stuff was gone. So now it's 5 or 6 in the evening, and the people at Walmart called us up and said there's a super center just up the road that sells that Yardman mower, sells those Yardman string trimmers. We're going to help you out. Go up there, get what you need. And so we went up there and got what we needed, and we were on the road by, I think, 11 o'clock at night.
Just barely made it, just before made. Midnight. But the problem is, of course, you were on the road in a floor model, and this is not going to take you 30 miles an hour across the country.
No, the floor models, they go about 5 or 6 miles an hour. And so the one that we had special gears cut for it to make it go that fast. But the problem is, what's different about this mow across America than 4 years ago is we're actually stopping in cities and working with the Keep America Beautiful affiliates to do cleanup and beautification programs in each community.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're going 5 miles an hour for this 200-mile journey. We have 3 days to get to Houston, which, you know, at 20, 25 miles an hour is no problem. But at five, we literally drove for 3 or 4 straight days. All day, and it was just a very caffeinated journey from San Antonio to Houston.
You also made a stop in Lawn, Texas. Did somebody call and say, hey, there's a place called Lawn, Texas, you guys got to stop there?
It was the weirdest thing, because in the meetings the night before, we kind of go through the cities and where we think we need to be by that evening. We're just kind of going city by city. We come across Lawn, we say, you got to be kidding me. Is that fate or what? So we spent the day in there. They took us to the mayor took us to lunch. We cut a bunch of lawns in town. It was a fun afternoon.
Now, your journey was originally due to end on the 5th of June. You had hoped to arrive at New York City's Battery Park on that date. Are you still anywhere near schedule?
If you can believe it, we caught up. We have been running probably 10 to 14-hour days since Houston. You know, our website, yardman.com, lists the cities that we'll be in. I know that you've got a huge audience, so we'd love to invite anybody to come out. It lists the sites, or you can find out where your local affiliate has some projects for your own community.
I think people are going to want to find out where they can get a lawnmower that goes 30 miles an hour.
Well, I'll tell you, there's only two on the planet right now. There's one that I'm wearing a fluorescent yellow shirt, so I'm not going to be difficult to spot. But if you see one without a guy with a fluorescent yellow shirt on it, that's probably the stolen one.
World record holder Brad Hodder talking to me from Fayetteville, Arkansas. Brad, good luck on the rest of the way to New York, and thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for making time for us today.
Beep, beep. I'm a roll runner, honey, and you can't keep up with me. I'm a roll runner, honey, and you can't keep up with me.
You're listening to Only a Game. On Wednesday afternoon, Iowa men's basketball coach Larry Eustace held a press conference to announce that he was an alcoholic and that he would seek treatment. In January, some hours after his team had lost a game to Missouri, Coach Eustace joined a group of students at a fraternity party on the Missouri campus. On Monday, photographs taken at the party were published in the Des Moines Register. Apparently, Coach Eustace behaved pretty much as people at fraternity parties are inclined to behave. Attending the party may seem an odd decision for a 47-year-old man to have made, but it's not unusual for alcoholics to make odd decisions. A couple of hours after Larry Eustace held his press conference, the athletic director at Iowa State, Bruce Vandeveld, held a press conference of his own to announce that the coach had been suspended. Vandeveld said he thought Eustace should be replaced because he had engaged in behavior, quote, inconsistent with his responsibilities. Alcoholics are inclined to do that. Actually, it's more or less one of the several defining characteristics of the disease, according to Alcoholics Anonymous. The particular matter of the future of Coach Larry Eustace has been the occasion of some debate. Anyone familiar with alcoholism will hope that he does, in fact, seek treatment and that he recognizes that the treatment will be long-term, as in for the rest of his life. His superiors at Iowa obviously prefer that he have his future somewhere else. His players, at least two of whom have said they may transfer if Eustachy is fired, want him retained. Either way, lawyers and agents will work out the details over the next little while. Compensation and restitution will be sorted out, and people who know more about college basketball than I do have surmised that when the last affidavit has been filed and the last promise to clam up has been made, Larry Eustachy will be coaching somewhere. That's the way it works in this business. More significant for the sports community and the community at large is the reminder apparent in this misadventure. Alcohol abuse, which is rampant on the sports landscape, can make a fool of a million-dollar coach just as quickly as it can make a bum of an athlete with a $10 million jump shot. Alcoholism is a disease that costs each league and every conference more than enough money to make any first-round draft pick's eyes go wide. In a sports culture dependent on the sale of alcohol and happy in the illusion that getting drunk is just good post-game fun, that's the dirty secret. If Larry Eustachy's sad misadventure can alert the odd player, coach, or administrator to that nasty fact, maybe the coach won't have fallen on his face in vain. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com, and from Nutter McLennan and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On National Public Radio's Weekend Edition Saturday, we want to bring you the news of the hour, of the week, and maybe some of the subtler stories and sidelights that can also be an important part of what's going on. Sports and entertainment, essays and literature, your neighborhood, our world. I'm Scott Simon. Please join us on Weekend Edition Saturday. Saturday morning at 8 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
I'm Dolores Handy with these sports headlines. In yesterday's National League action, the Cubs topped the Rockies 7-4. The Mets mauled Milwaukee 9-3. Houston edged Florida 4-3. St. Louis beat Montreal 8-1. And San Diego foiled Philadelphia 5-4. Elsewhere, Atlanta beat Arizona 4-2. Pittsburgh topped Los Angeles 5-3. And Cincinnati triumphed over San Francisco 5-1. For Only a Game, I'm Dolores Handy in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Stalking the Woolly Mammoth, and lesser game. But first, our analyst Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Lakers handily defeated the Minnesota Timberwolves 4-2, and they will face San Antonio in the second round of the NBA playoffs. Are the Spurs at all beginning to sweat?
I think that the Spurs are probably the only team in the Western Conference that doesn't tremble in their shoes when they go out and play the Lakers. I think this is going to be a terrific series. I think that Tim Duncan does not approach the Lakers with any fear or any trepidation regarding the way the Lakers have played the last 3 years, and I think they're about the only team in the West you can say that about.
Elsewhere in the same playoffs, on Wednesday, Sacramento eliminated the Utah Jazz. Will that game mark the last on-court collaboration between those two wonderful old fellows, Karl Malone and John Stockton?
Well, it looks like Malone is going to go look for a ring, which possibly means he turns up with the Lakers next year. And it looks like Stockton is finally going to retire. And, yes, it's we thought that Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish and Larry Bird were going to be the three guys who played mostly their entire careers together and be the last of those. But these guys have proven us wrong. I can't see anybody anywhere else in the league that's going to do this. I mean, Kobe and Shaq will stay together for a while, but they won't be staying around for 17 or 18 years.
Meanwhile, the Ducks continue to quack mightily. They swept the defending Stanley Cup champs in the first round of the NHL playoffs. They're up 3-1 against Dallas, the top seed in the West. Will Anaheim waddle all the way to the Cup?
Well, it's the hot goalie theory, obviously, and Jean-Sebastien Jaguar was not a fluke against Detroit. But the interesting thing, of course, that's happening in the West is the West, which, like in the NBA, was the seat of most of the league's talent, could conceivably have a finals contested between the Anaheim Mighty Ducks and the Minnesota Wild, the team that's existed for about 11 and a half minutes.
It has not been a great week for college coaches whose teams aren't playing. Having been photographed partying...
Well, it's been fun.
Well, you're right. Definition of great is open for discussion. But anyway, photographed partying with students at a frat house on the Missouri campus, Iowa State basketball coach Larry Eustace has acknowledged that he's an alcoholic. I gather that acknowledgement may very well not save his job.
It looks like the university fathers in Ames are fed up with this. Apparently, it wasn't the first on-campus party that Coach Eustace attended, thereby proving once again the truth of the philosophy of Dean Vernon Wormer of Faber College, that fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life. For me, I don't know that this is a firing offense, but for me, it's astonishing that Larry Eustace, the basketball coach at Iowa State, is the highest paid state employee in the state of Iowa. Where does that put the Iowa football coach? He must be outraged.
As usual, Charlie, cutting to the meat of the issue.
That's
instantly, right. Meanwhile, Alabama football coach-elect Mike Price, who has yet to coach a game for his new employer, may not get the chance to do that. I gather he chose the wrong roommate when he was on the road for a pro-am golf tournament.
He apparently spent time with a dancer from a Pensacola nightclub. And when I say dancer, I don't mean Alvin Ailey.
Mm-hmm.
I mean someone further down the terpsichorial food chain. I have actually interviewed Mike Price. I interviewed him years ago for a story I did for GQ. Mike Price is like your grandfather. I mean, this is literally like finding Ward Cleaver in the Golden Banana. This is really an alarming story.
This is an image I will not be able easily to lose. Is it time to worry about the national hockey team? At the Hockey World Championships, the U.S. has ridden a 3-game losing streak into the oblivion of the consolation round, victims of not only Russia, but Switzerland and Denmark. No miracles to believe in there, eh?
I think it's certainly time to worry about the fact that I did not even know that the Hockey World Championships were going on, much less that they were going on in Turku, Finland. Yes, the Americans are losing to what we would call in another context the directional schools in the field, where they are losing to the Southeast Missouri State of Nations. Well, the interesting thing the other night was that Ilya Kovalchuk, who plays for the Atlanta Thrashers, managed to win the game with a goal while faking out a 39-year-old defenseman named Phil Housley. Now, I didn't realize, number one, that this tournament was going all, but much less that we were sending our senior division team to play there.
Charlie, it is, of course, Derby Day.
Of course
one
it is.
Jockey who was supposed to be there but won't is the until recently indestructible 56-year-old Lafitte Pinkai Jr. Doctors recently discovered that an injury Pinkai suffered in March is, in fact, a broken neck. And so, using common sense, he has retired. Did Mr. Pinkai ever win one for you?
Not to my knowledge, but he was an affable and terrific guy who at one point in my career, we were at the Belmont, and they had as part of the pre-race entertainment at this party, they had an elephant and a camel. And somebody concocted a race down the backstretch in which the elephant and the camel raced. And as I recall, Mr. Pinkai rode the elephant and won the race. And when we asked him afterwards, he said, I knew I had it because I still had a lot of elephant under me.
Does it seem politically significant to you that this derby might come down to a battle between empire maker and peace rules?
Actually, I have scanned the field and I find not one but two long shots. With Seattle SLU in their background on their mommy's side, which is my all-purpose plunging bet. So mm-hmm. I am ignoring the favorites and concentrating on Awfully Wild, spelled O-F-F-L-E-E, and That's What I'm Talking About, which is all one word. So I'm not betting grammar. I'm betting damn side.
You heard it here first in case either of those crosses
the line. Not that I'm betting at all.
First.
I'm just saying that.
On Wednesday, Colorado Rockies reliever Todd Jones apologized to his team for his recent anti-gay remarks, unless he didn't.
Well, he apologized. He said that the thing he shouldn't have done was make his views public.
So that was the apology.
Which is pretty much the way we handle these things these days. You can believe anything you want, no matter what position you're in, as long as you shut up about them in public. It was a bad story. Todd Jones, who never been mistaken for a nuclear physicist on his best day, indeed should have kept his mouth shut, but more to the point, he should look at himself and find out why he believes all this nonsense.
Well, you know, why do you suppose he didn't apologize to fans? Is he afraid that he might give approximately 10% of them the wrong idea?
Well, I think that's probably possible. You know, he apologized to his teammates for, quote-unquote, putting them through this, which was a good thing because he did make them answer questions they probably didn't want to answer. But, you know, there is a substantial portion of his audience, which is not only gay, but there's a substantial portion of his population that is related to gay people, that love gay people as sons and daughters and sisters and brothers, and he ought to apologize to all of them.
The Toronto Blue Jays sold out Tuesday night's game by offering tickets for $1. Blue Jays President Paul Godfrey said it was a way for Toronto to say, quote, we're a safe and healthy city despite the SARS outbreak. A message to players on opposing teams who didn't want to come to Toronto?
Well, make a point clear, however, that $1 Canadian, which means in American money, the tickets cost 69 cents.
69 cents.
This was a nice response to what was really kind of a media-fueled panic over this disease. It does prove that Toronto Blue Jays will play baseball at any price. I mean, people will go see them. Unfortunately, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday against Kansas City, they didn't draw more than 17,000 fans.
Finally, Charlie, one of the most tradition-bound sports venues is eliminating one of its traditions. There will be no more bowing and curtsying to the Royal Box at Wimbledon.
Well, the problem is they've been bowing and curtsying to the people who were pretty far down the old depth chart royal-wise. I mean, they were bowing to the countess and curtsying to the human duchy of Grand Fenwick. Now they can just bow if the queen or Prince Charles, or eldest son and heir to the throne, are in the box, which I think is sort of like chainsawing through the bureaucracy in the way I like to see it. I myself would not bow except to a queen. Or perhaps to Muddy Waters if you're still alive.
My understanding is there will be no bowing and curtsying because neither the queen nor Prince Charles has any use for tennis at all. Charlie Pierce, the king of sports analysts, writes for the Boston Globe Sunday magazine and joins me each week so that I can bow in his direction. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
By the wild rose thicket, Phyllis went to play, calling woman after her down the woodbine way. Oh, the summer days are sweet, let old sorrow go.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
Why does the racket tremble? And why does he seize the hand? And why is a golden glory shed o'er them where they stand? Is it only a game of tennis?
Thousand years ago, success in target sports provided food and survival. These days, marksmanship is more likely to provide recreation or, at best, Olympic obscurity. But there's at least one place, Celebration Park, Idaho, where one can explore the multifaceted nature of one particular target sport. Only a Game's Jeff Rice has this report.
Now concentrate. Better take the woolly mammoth down with one throw, or tonight we go hungry. Maybe I just get stomped. Okay. Get ready. Rear back.
throat. I'm never going to get the hang of this. There are no mastodons in Idaho's Melba Valley on the edge of the Snake River. Instead, there are a half dozen people practicing for an upcoming atlatl competition.
Who's that?
An atlatl is an ancient throwing device that looks like a flat tree branch with a handle. The throwing darts are 5 feet long and deadly sharp. Atlatl competition involves throwing the darts at targets on hay bales. In the hands of an experienced thrower, the dart flies amazingly straight. This primitive hunting method, once preferred by generations of prehistoric nomads, is catching on as a competitive target sport. There's a World Atlatl Association and dozens of sanctioned contests throughout the U.S. Today at Celebration Park, where the cliffs rise up out of the riverbed, there are three generations of competitive atlatl throwers present, including Dean Pritchard, last year ranked 13th in the world.
I saw a bunch of people over throwing sticks with what appeared to be another stick. And I thought to myself, my gosh, that looks like a lot of fun.
And his wife, Judy, once in the top 10.
I like it when it thwunks.
Their 40-year-old son, Quinn, a formidable distance competitor.
Just whack, and there's a nice, solid sound.
And their 18-year-old granddaughter, Alex Pritchard, the 2000 World Junior Champion.
And it's just so much fun.
Yeah! Oh! Grab this forward!
About 500 people, including the Pritchards, are known to compete globally. Dean Pritchard looks forward to each atlatl season.
Typically, we'll drive around the country in the RV and hit, I think like 7 or 8 atlatl contests, most of them being this side of the Mississippi River. It's still in its infancy here in this part of the country, but back east, you know, it's really becoming popular, especially in New York and Pennsylvania.
According to Dean's son, Quinn, you meet an interesting crowd.
You have people showing up in loincloths and homemade beadwork and basically... Hey, Elizabeth, nice job. Just go 10,000 years back in time, and there they are. And then my folks show up in their Winnebago with their china and stoves and microwaves.
There are no loincloths in evidence today, but as the saying goes, you can take the person out of the cave, but you can't take the cave out of the person. Judy Pritchard.
I think we are probably pretty primitive. Everybody else marches forward, and we're marching backwards into the primitive realm.
Out on the throwing range, Dean Pritchard gives me some pointers.
Okay, first of all, get your hand on that loop, make a twist.
Unlike archery, which requires the ability to remain still, Pritchard says atlatl is all about the proper motion.
But you got to get that monkey motion under control.
That's what I, as a first-time atlatler, am told I must acquire.
Monkey motion, yes.
But that's what I'm not getting. The monkey motion, the technical term, I believe, is a zen-like hurl similar to a particular motion practiced by millions.
If a person fishes a lot, they're easy to teach because the throwing motion is very similar to casting a line in the water with a fishing pole.
If there are relatively few serious competitors right now, many thousands have at least tried the sport. At Celebration Park in southwestern Idaho, atlatl throwing is a big draw, especially for school or Boy Scout field trips.
We get about 15,000 kids a year participating in the atlatl throwing down here.
Tom Bychak manages Celebration Park and makes atlatls available for use by the public. His interest in the sport grew from his interest in archaeology.
The park has been continuously occupied for 10,000 years, and the tool of, or weapon of choice for killing the Pleistocene megafauna in this area were atlatls. And those very old atlatl weights and spurs have been found in the archaeological habitation sites down here. So, yeah, this isn't anything new. 10,000 years, everybody's been doing the same thing down here, throwing atlatls and picnicking and camping out.
All this gave Bychak an idea.
We just started whittling sticks and playing with it a little bit, and then all of a sudden one day it all kind of gelled, and we kind of figured it out. And from then on, it just became one of the programs.
An estimated 100,000 people have thrown atlatls at the park since the program started. Today, Boy Scout Troop 198 from Meridian, Idaho, lines up to give it a try.
All right, boys.
Okay.
Everybody pick up the atlatl.
About a dozen 9- and 10-year-olds let fly all at once.
Oh!
Yeah!
According to the rules of modern atlatl chucking, you get 12 shots. You take the score for your best 10 throws, up to a score of 100. The best official score ever recorded is 98. So far, I have a score of 0. On my last attempt, the dart flies true and sticks into the hay bale.
Let it be known that Jeff actually hit the target within a dozen throws.
But it was outside the circle. No points. But hey, not entirely skunked. I'll be back to try again. I've just got to work on that elusive atlatl motion.
You got to get that monkey motion under control.
For Only a Game, I'm Jeff Rice in Celebration Park, Idaho.
The Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from John Hoder and Glenn Alexander. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or gain a visual fix on modern atlatlers, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from former Secretariat owner Penny Chenery, who remembers one of the wackiest publicity ideas after Big Red's 1973 Triple Crown victory.
The most far-out one was this man made the proposal that we collect his manure and encase a ball of manure in plastic as a paperweight.
As ideas go, that one to me just really sounds... Oh, never mind. I feel a little field. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.